One of the key tenets of this program is the idea that we all deserve to live as our full, authentic selves. Usually I'm speaking in the context of Jewish identity, but we are all multifaceted humans, and I guarantee you that many of us have other aspects of our identity that we continue to either conceal or with which we are not yet fully in line. Today, I want to share with you my journey of self-discovery that brought me into alignment as my full, authentic self for the first time in a long time. Not because I have a burning desire to talk about myself, but because, as always, I hope my words maybe knock a little something loose in your brain that just needed a little nudge. Let's start somewhere Jewish, that being the theme of this show and all. From age 2 to age 13, I attended Jewish day school, and the experience was a mixed bag, to say the least. When I had challenging and empathetic teachers, I thrived. When I had rigid and overwhelmed teachers, I got into trouble. My parents and teachers chalked this up to a combined lack of intellectual stimulation and an inability to control myself, which was very bad indeed. By the time I graduated 8th grade, I had received 30 detentions, 2 suspensions, been compared to a Nazi by the Judaic Studies director, and received 1 in-school suspension, a punishment they made up just for me on my very last day of school before graduation. Good times. Fast forward to 2023. 15 years into my never-ending struggle to achieve success in the entertainment industry, jumping from writing to acting to music to producing, always trying to have as many balls in the air as possible. And yet, I was in a constant state of feeling disappointed in myself. Why wasn't I more prolific? Why wasn't I breaking through? How would I ever reach my full potential? If I tried something else, wouldn't that make me a loser, a quitter, a coward? Around this time, my son, who had been having clear impulse control issues from age 2, was diagnosed with ADHD. They don't actually distinguish it from ADD anymore. It's all ADHD now. His diagnosis brought great relief for me and my wife. Weekly shout out to Courtney. We began to learn all the different ways ADHD could manifest. How so many things that we might chalk up to rudeness or forgetfulness or defiance were in fact just symptoms of a condition over which my little boy has little control. I recognized a lot of myself when I saw my kid, and that realization, on top of the strong urge I had to find more achievement in my own life, led me to get tested for ADHD. And wouldn't you know it, I've got it too. And while I appreciated having that new knowledge, I didn't really put any effort into trying to understand what it meant, so it didn't do me much good. In fact, as the year went on, my mental state continued to deteriorate. I'd always felt I lacked purpose. What am I supposed to do with my life? Who am I supposed to be? And with those existential questions turning over and over in my mind, I always felt like my life was lacking, despite it being so full with so many blessings. Things came to a head during the summer. I was in a constant state of frustration. My meter always at 99, so the tiniest thing would push me right to 100. Nothing felt worthwhile. I didn't seek out any of the things that bring me joy. I wasn't getting work. Everything was just going through the motions, hollow. After I lost my temper one too many times over nothing, my wife and I both demanded that something had to change in me immediately. So I made 3 major changes, and almost overnight, I became a totally different person in the best way. The first change was medication. Sweet, sweet sertraline, baby. Overnight, my impulsivity was curbed, and the temperature on my temper turned all the way down. I can't overstate how amazing it feels to not have impulsivity getting in the way of the person I truly am. The second change was that, at my wife's urging, I got serious about trying to understand my ADHD. Most of us who don't know any better think of it as a condition that's exclusive to kids who can't sit still in school. Not super meaningful to an adult who has done well professionally, has a family, all that. Boy, oh boy, as I dug into a book called The ADHD Effect on Marriage by Melissa Orlov, we discovered that so many facets of my core personality, including many of the behaviors I had been told were bad or made me bad, were actually manifestations of my ADHD. Like when I forget to lower the garage door, it's not because I don't care about my family's safety. It's because between the time I open the garage door and think, I gotta remember to close that, and then get into my car 4 seconds later, I've already thought about 20 other things. So if I don't happen to notice the open door in my rear view, it never re-enters my mind to close it. The trouble I have getting started on non-preferred projects. It's not because I'm lazy or dumb. It's because people with ADHD have a hard time getting started on non-preferred projects. My impulsivity is not because I'm a bad person. It's because my brain moves really fast and doesn't produce enough dopamine and is constantly searching for stimuli. I also learned that some of my struggles could actually be superpowers. When Courtney calls my name and I don't answer, it's not because I'm ignoring her, but because I have hyperfocus and can get into such a deep flow state that the world disappears. Understanding moments like these has been a huge win for both of us personally and for our marriage. Another fascinating one, ADHD brains don't employ hierarchical thinking the way non-ADHD brains do. So while a regular brain sorts various tasks or details by order of importance, my brain treats everything as equally important, which is why everything I've ever produced, from scripts to vocal arrangements to lyrics to this podcast, is so meticulously picked over and my standards set so high. But what really blew my mind was reading the expansive list of ADHD symptoms courtesy of Dr. Edward Hallowell, things I had no idea were ADHD related. A sense of underachievement and insecurity, regardless of how much one has actually accomplished. Many projects going on simultaneously. Impulsivity. Inaccurate self-observation. It was me to a T. The transformation was instantaneous. By realizing how much of my lifelong internal struggle was due to my own brain's erroneous view of myself, I was able to let go of that struggle and embrace myself in a way I never would have even considered. The last change was committing to the creation of this podcast. My ADHD told me I wasn't successful enough, that my worth was less because I hadn't reached a high enough height, and that until I did, I would never realize my full potential and my life would be wasted. But once I understood where these false ideas actually came from, I stopped believing them. I realized that so much of the turmoil I'd been experiencing was due to the internal conflict between my mind, which told me I had to keep my foot on the gas of entertainment at all costs, and my heart, which told me there was a pursuit far more significant and potentially impactful waiting for me if I would only take it up. Rather than spend an afternoon prepping an audition for a four-line role on The Rookie, I could spend that time trying to empower and educate folks about the modern experience of being Jewish. Understanding my ADHD allowed me to release myself from the shackles of unfair expectations and step gratefully into the role I was meant to play all along. You know, I actually always hated when people shared stories like mine, because it's not like anyone is trying to be spiritually misaligned. I had to organically stumble into my situation after lots of struggling. So just because I can say, hey, do this and you'll feel great, doesn't necessarily help you in any way. Your circumstances are your own. But I do feel there is a universal truth at play here. Your gut, your instinct, your inner voice, your soul, your intuition, your divine spark, whatever you want to call it, is always right. We do our damnedest to ignore it, to allow our brains or our emotions or the brains and emotions of other people to drown out the wisdom that's already there. Feeling out of alignment, bereft of the ease that comes from inhabiting your full authentic self, is your insight telling you that there are warring factions at play within you? Recognize this. Examine it. Tease out the intuition from the impulse, the natural from the noise, the push towards salvation from the pull of fear and doubt. As the ghost of Babe Ruth says in The Sandlot, follow your heart, kid, and you'll never go wrong. So follow yours. And when you do, I'll be here, waiting to wish you an enthusiastic mazel tov. Well, waiting at least until my brain needs more dopamine and I gotta go do something else. But you get it, because you at last are you, and I'm just being me. This is the 13th episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt. Folks, if you don't already have a snack handy to enjoy during the episode, now would be a good time to grab one, because today I'm in Philadelphia, sitting down with arguably the most well-known ambassador of Israeli cuisine in the world.
Check out these numbers. By the end of this year, he'll have 9 restaurants open. He's a 4-time cookbook co-author and a 5-time James Beard Award winner, including Outstanding Restaurant for his flagship Zahav, the first Israeli-American restaurant to win the honor, and where I absolutely demolished dinner last night. We are not cooking today, but I'm hoping he'll still bring us some food for thought. Please welcome Chef Michael Solomonov.
Thank you so much, man.
On this weekend of all weekends, your son's bar mitzvah was this weekend. Yeah. And here you are. How was that?
It was very emotional. It was like my son is named after my brother, David, who, you know, died in the IDF. He was killed in the IDF. And so like it was, I think it meant a lot to my family to be there, to be able to celebrate him as well. So yeah, it was great, man. That's it was beautiful. Great. You haven't done any bar mitzvahs yet, right?
Not for my kids?
Yeah.
No, my oldest is 5.
Yeah, so you got some time.
My nephew was bar mitzvahed this past year.
How did it go?
He's like the first of that generation. It was amazing. It's just what you described. You know, so nice to have everybody together,
right.
Celebratory.
Right.
Now more than ever.
Totally. Well, I think that is, you know, something obviously you talk about all the time, which is like the most Jewish thing, which is like to, you know, Jews are great at like grieving. We are great at mourning. We are great at eating. We are great at celebrating. And all those things come with very good food, right?
Yeah. Certainly at your gatherings, I'd imagine.
Well, my gatherings, but you know, it's like, so we had the owner of Radin's Deli who used to own 4th Street, famous 4th Street, which you probably
ate at. I don't think so.
Oh, it was on 4th and Bainbridge. It's still there.
Okay.
He sold it, but Russ Cowan is like a multi-generation deli man. And my mom, who passed away 8 years ago, but is buried in Israel, lived in Israel the last 20 years of her life. Every time she would come to Philly to visit us, she would get deli because like deli in Israel sucks, right? Not good. Not what everybody out there is thinking.
That's it, right? Because they don't have the good livestock, right?
It's not good deli. And so my mom, she would come to Philly and get hot fudge sundaes at Franklin Fountain and wolf down these giant pastrami and like chopped liver sandwiches. Now she weighed like 90 pounds. I don't know
good metabolism.
How she did. Thank God. She was also like a very heavy smoker. But she like just loved this deli. And so on her birthday, my ex-wife, my wife, my kids, we all have, which is on Christmas Eve, we all go to this deli and we get pastrami sandwiches. And so I asked Russ, I was like, listen, man, I know that you don't cater. It's my son's bar mitzvah. We like your cooking, your deli is like part of our life. And so he catered it.
That's so cool. And I saw you posted online the Shabbat dinner for the weekend was at Pho 75.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Tell me how that happened.
I lived in South Philly for a very long time. My sons and my daughter, like, you know, their first meals in restaurants were at Pho. Everybody in Philly in the chef community eats at Pho 75. It's an amazing place. I don't know if you've been there yet.
Hot tip, everybody.
Pho 75 on 12th and Washington is the best breakfast, lunch, and dinner you will ever have.
Wow.
I get the number 9 or number 14 small meat on top. Amazing.
That's awesome.
Very nonchalant. I know people probably expect me to have like multi-course whatever, but that's just not in the cards, man.
Yeah. Was there a lot of cooking in your house growing up?
Yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of cooking in my house. Both my parents were really good cooks. We didn't eat in restaurants very often. And so she did most of the cooking and it was phenomenal. Yeah.
What was her like go-to cuisine or style?
Even though we were very secular, Shabbat dinner was still kind of a thing.
Oh yeah.
And so like fresh challah and like the brisket or the roast chicken or like the, you know, rice pilaf or like when my grandmother would visit from Israel, which was like every other year, it was like borekas and schnitzel and like all that stuff. So food was very important in our household. We were not fancy eaters and like we probably ate chicken like 4 nights out of the week.
What were some of the dishes that you really looked forward to having growing up?
My Israeli grandmother would make the most incredible stuffed peppers that my mom sort of learned how to make. And so stuffed peppers were like big. I mean, even when I would go back to
beef?
Beef and rice, or sometimes just rice, but like beef and rice. My grandmother would use like green pepper. She was like frugal or whatever, so green pepper. We grew up with like green peppers, you know, and
they were cheaper than red,
and they are also delicious. But like again, not as like fancy as red, but that kind of stuff I really enjoyed. Periodically, we would get like lamb chops.
My dad we had like some lamb chops.
Crush those on the grill,
good.
So good. The thing is, my parents worked a ton. My mom was like a teacher at a Solomon Schechter school. My dad was a jeweler and then owned like a Subway sandwich place. And so my parents worked like very, very hard, you know? And, but priority to them was still home cooked meals all the time.
That's amazing.
And it's so, I mean, I work nights, you know, but Sunday, Monday, and Tuesdays, I really try to be at home. And like only since COVID have I discovered how much I love not just the act of cooking in my home, not with like a professional kitchen, but really like cooking for my family. And again, that sounds like so cliched, but it is so meaningful.
You're talking about growing up. Did you, you were born in Israel, but you do you mostly feel like your childhood was in the States?
So my childhood was in the States. So I was born in Israel. We moved to Pittsburgh when I was three. My mom grew up in East Liverpool, Ohio. And then when, whatever, after college or whatever, she made Aliyah, met my dad, and then they moved to the States after they had me. So from three to like 15, we grew up in Squirrel Hill, Pittsburgh, which is kind of a shtetl too. Like Squirrel Hill is, I grew up thinking that most American cities had people speaking Yiddish in the streets.
Wow.
Like, it was very cool. We moved to Israel. And then I was there for 1 year in boarding school in this place in a town called Pardes Chana. And when I got back to the States, I was like, something doesn't feel right. Like I'm very American, right? But I don't feel like I totally belong here. But when I'm over there, I'm like, I need somebody to be polite.
Right.
Even if it's bullshit, like just say, you know, just bring it for a second.
Just tone it down.
I mean, that's informed my identity. Obviously, that is my identity. And also as it relates to like bringing Israeli food to the US, it kind of, you know, it sort of fits. Like I have a foot in the door kind of in both places and I'm not totally comfortable in either. But it was a really like incredible time. Statistically, you're much safer over there than you are here.
Right.
And as a 15-year-old, we could like hitchhike to like Caesarea, go to Jerusalem for the weekend. Mm-hmm. Every other weekend, we could be off campus. And we could, we would just try to get as far as we could like 50 shekels. Every time I go back, people are still like, well, don't you feel unsafe? And I'm like, dude, I live in Philly, bro. Like the likelihood of me getting murdered outside of the studio, way greater, even now than—
Totally. So you mentioned your brother was killed while serving in the IDF.
Yes.
Your older, younger brother.
Younger.
Younger brother.
Yeah.
I don't think people realize how common that is to be Israeli and have someone close to you have been killed in some conflict or some war. Or—
well, Memorial Day over there is very different than here. Here, there's like sales on electronics and people go to the beach. And over there, every single person is affected.
Right.
So it's a very different thing. And over there, there's mandatory draft.
Yep.
Here, most of our people don't know what that means. And David was killed by Hezbollah snipers. He was in Metula, which is the northernmost
town. At the top,
in an apple orchard. And he was killed by Hezbollah snipers that fired through the border that were in Lebanon on October 6th, which happened to be Yom Kippur that year in 2003. So it was like 3 days before his release So, yeah, it was a drag.
How did that impact the trajectory that you were on?
Changed everything.
In what way?
A month before he was killed, I'd been working at Vetri restaurant, which you'd probably
eaten at. Yes, which I've eaten at.
And Mark at that time would close for the month of August, which is like a very Italian thing to do. And it just so, right before your release in the IDF, you get like a break. And it so happened that they coincided. So my mom bought me a plane ticket under the condition that I would cook dinner for friends. And I flew over and David and I hung out for like 3 weeks together. And like, we'd been living on different continents for years. So it was really meaningful. And I had become kind of a chef and David was serving in Golani, like an infantry, you know, he was a sniper in Golani Brigade. And so we had very different lives and it was, there was no like younger or older. We were just like very close. And like, it was like this realization that I had like discovered my best friend, you know? And so we had spent 3 weeks shopping around the country, getting food so I could cook dinner for my mom's friends, going to like clubs and hanging out at the beach and just like really, you know, I just have a lot of gratitude for that moment. That was the first thing my mom said when I spoke to her after, you know, she called. The first thing she said was, I'm just so, you know, so happy you guys had that time together because it was incredibly meaningful. So after his funeral, I came back to the States and like whatever feeling I had coming back from boarding school, it was that times 100. How do you relate to people in the States?
Right.
What do people know here about siblings getting killed in the military, especially where we live in the North? Mm-hmm. We have no relationship to that.
Yeah.
What do people know about borders? I mean, a terrorist organization that under condition of like either ceasefire or withdraw from Israel should have been north of the Litani River.
Yeah.
And next to UN peacekeepers were firing across an international border at Israeli soldiers, right?
Yeah.
My brother killed by three snipers. And I guess since we're getting real right now, where's the fucking outrage?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing.
And so I think it's very difficult. And again, we don't have to get very political about this, but as you can imagine, it's very difficult to come back and relate to people after that.
Totally.
Nobody understand. Knows what that means.
Right.
My friends.
They have a lot of opinions, but they don't really know what it means.
Well, it's funny. They have a lot of opinions now, but at the time it was just like, war, terrible. Or like, wow, that's really fucked up. How could that have happened? And I didn't even ask you if I could swear on your show here.
You can't.
Okay,
you're good to go.
Excellent.
Yeah.
But so I think that people didn't really want to touch it. But even when I talk about my brother right now, I mean, people are like, well, you know, IDF soldier. And I'm like, what? Think about how the US would tolerate something like this.
Right.
Right? Think about what the outrage would be. And so at the time, my brother should have been alive. I mean, it was 3 days before his release. And, you know, I remember the Apple farmer where he was killed basically in an apple orchard, and the farmer Moshe, who has since passed away, but brought this bushel of apples to the Shiva, and it was like they were so sweet, you know. And that part of the country is just shockingly beautiful, and it's right by the Good Fence. So there was a time where Lebanese citizens were in Israel like working, or there was an open, not exactly an open border, but it was like chill,
right,
you know.
Right.
And so this was before the war with Lebanon in 2006, mm-hmm. before the Israeli soldiers got taken hostage, and before ultimately, on condition of a ceasefire, there should have been another withdrawal to north of the Litani River, which has also never happened. But
never.
So it is, I mean, it changed everything. I didn't really understand how this sort of land that produced these incredibly sweet apples could also have this sort of like stain of like my brother's blood and spirit. And it was just a hard thing to sort of explain to people here. Listen, think about the border crisis that we talk about here in the States.
Yeah.
Very different. Canada, Mexico.
Completely different.
Very different.
There's no Canadian snipers.
Exactly. So I came back and I was the sous chef at Vetri. And a few months later, we would close for like Christmas and New Year's. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to go back and cook for my brother's army unit, which was still in Matula, which was an old British mandate base. And I told Mark Vetri, and he's like, I'm going to come with you and cook.
Wow.
You know, which was like hilarious because he was also like, let's roast a suckling pig. And I was like, they're not going to let us do that, you know? And then he was like, we'll make ossobuco. And I was like, yeah, right. So we made like schnitzel for, you know, 250 of my brother soldiers.
That's awesome.
And he was about to get released, so like he was the sort of veteran, so everybody there knew him, and really it's amazing to learn about him sort of afterwards. I mean, he was really a great guy. And so we cooked this meal, and Mark just looked, on the drive up even, he looked like a zombie. And I was like, dude, why didn't you sleep? And he was like, I was on one of those like Birthright planes, and it was just like kids like getting it's fucked up and partying the whole time. And so he looked like a zombie. And then we cooked this meal, and my brother's commander is like, we're driving him around the border. And then we cooked this amazing meal, and at the end of it, he looked like super emotional, right? And I was like, dude, are you okay? And he was like, you know, this morning I was surrounded by these like 20-year-old American kids that were going on this like free vacation. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, now I'm like surrounded by these like 20-year-old Israeli kids like your brother that are in uniform, covered in mud, that have 5 minutes to eat before they have to go out and like defend a country.
Yeah.
And it just was like so, you know, even 21 years later, it's still very emotional, right?
I totally understand.
And that. So for me, I was like, now he gets it. And Mark grew up Jewish American, had been to Israel once before that, but wasn't affected the way he was then.
Right.
And I was like, you know, I can't, like, I need to figure out how to become closer to my brother. And it's fucking hard because he's not around now, you know? Right. So after that, my business partner, my current business partner, Steve, is like one of my best friends.
Nice.
I kept hearing about him because he was the other Jewish line cook in Philadelphia.
Uh-huh.
Right? And so I met Steve Cook, and Steve hired me to be the chef of Marigold Kitchen.
Yes.
On 45th Street.
Which I frequented with my college girlfriend. Shout out to Rachel. Hope you're doing great.
Yeah, Rachel's doing just fine.
It was fantastic. I loved that place. It was BYO, which BYO, when you're in college, that's, you know,
you can
what
bring
you're
in
looking
a box
for.
Of wine. Yeah. No,
exactly. Bring me your Carlo Rossi or your Yellow
Chablis,
Tail.
A
or
cooking
whatever.
Chablis. So
you knew him before you got to Marigold. He brought you in.
I knew him because he wanted a chef for Marigold because he was stepping down, and he hired me as a chef.
Okay, so that was your first real interaction.
That was my first chef's job, my first like head chef job. Mm-hmm. And that was our first introduction. Steve was like son and brother of a rabbi and was married to Shira, who I knew from Squirrel Hill. So that was like enough for me, right?
Yeah.
And I guess it was enough for him to hire me as the chef too. And so Steve was cooking more like new American, but like very Ashkenazi heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And I cooked more, I guess, Sephardic or Mizrahi. And we got a bunch of accolades. And at some point I'd gone back to visit my family in Israel, which I did every year. And like the experience of sitting down at a restaurant, having like 20 different salads, having the hummus, the laffa, the pita, the shipudim, everything cooked a la esh, that not only was like delicious, such an exciting way to eat, but also was so different than like what fancy chefs were doing in the States was amazing. And it also explained the story of Israeli cuisine, kind of warts and all, right? It was like dozens of diasporic Jewish, there was indigenous Palestinian, there was everything shooken up and just sort of spilled onto the table. And I was like, this, why are we not doing this, you know? And that was the sort of the catalyst for opening Zahav.
So you come back from that experience and these things have crystallized in your mind and you go to Steve, like, let's open a Israeli restaurant.
And Steve was like, fuck yeah, let's do it. You know?
Wow. Yeah. And now here we are 7 restaurants later. And
16 years. I mean, Zahav is 16 years old.
16
man.
Years
That's
old.
That's like 100 years.
Yeah.
You know?
I was a senior at Penn when it opened.
Yeah.
So I remember it.
Yeah.
Let me just say about Zahav, I had like the greatest meal there last night.
Thank you so much.
Every bite was better than the next. I mean, when you hear a restaurant so highly lauded, you're like, okay, let's see what it's about.
It almost makes it harder to get people excited.
Of course.
Yeah.
But it's like, it totally delivers. It was just every bite of it was like the best cabbage dish I've ever had in the Salad Team.
The pickled cabbage. With
the
sumac.
At the beginning, I don't eat cabbage, and this was so good. And my favorite dish of all, I think, was probably the oyster mushroom kebab.
Oh my god! Yeah, with the harissa and the
It's like whatever it's soaked in that like makes it.
It's like chicken-y,
you got
right?
a little like, sweet umami, kind of some spice, like all together.
Yeah.
It was just We had the best time. It was so good.
It makes me happy, man. Thank you.
Yeah, get on the list. You got to get yourself there if you haven't been.
You just got a call. We were going to put your cell phone number out here.
Yeah, there we go. Perfect.
Yeah.
What do you think it is about your approach to the cuisine that's elevated it to this level?
For us, it was really about, you know, in a way, advocating for this country that is like so, continues to be so misunderstood.
Yeah.
And I was like, listen, if people leave here and they turn on the TV and there's imagery or messaging about Israel, and this was actually way easier 16 years ago than it is now.
Sure.
And they have this idea about Israel, and they're like, but you know what? I ate at this Israeli place, and like, it was cool. And I didn't, you know, find it to be problematic or whatever. Mm-hmm. If people can leave our restaurant and say, and have a better idea or something more positive to say about Israel, which is a country that they, let's face it, know nothing about,
right.
I'm okay with that.
You mentioned, you know, that you give credit to other cultures, cuisines that make their way into the Israeli cuisine.
Definitely.
Yeah. How often are you hearing and how are you dealing with people being, say, you know,
cultural
Israeli food is appropriated from Palestinians?
Well, I guess there's like the truth, which is that it's fucking food and like
everybody's eating
what? Yeah, I don't know. You're talking about pizza in LA. Do you think there are Italians that are like, no, you stole it from us or what? I don't know. I mean, we could just go on and on. I think it's bullshit. You know, I think all of it, the older I get, the more I'm like, I just don't want to hear it. Like, I don't know. California and Texas were Mexico 100 years before Israeli independence. Right. You eat tacos there without people vandalizing your fucking taco shop. Like, I don't want to hear it. Yeah. It's stupid. Okay. It's stupid. But if I were Palestinian living in the West Bank, under occupation, going through checkpoints, having my olive trees burned, I'd be fucking pissed off that I'm Mike Solomonov is has a homeless company is like doing really well.
Right.
I will say that both Israelis and Palestinians did not invent hummus. Okay. So like,
where'd it come from?
It came from Egypt, more than likely.
Is that where falafel came from too?
I've falafel is 4th century Coptic Christian, and it was like the answer to like meat on Lent. Okay. And I'll tell you, the Coptic Christians are not doing very well right now.
No.
Either. And nobody says a goddamn word about that.
Yeah.
Israelis helped market it. And like, they're good. We are good at doing that. And that's fine. And like, denying the fact that there's Palestine or Palestinians or Palestinian culture is also bullshit. And that we have to, you know, when it comes to things like food, we have to be able to give credit to where it's due. But most of the time when I'm hearing this, it's like, you've appropriated this. Israeli food doesn't exist. And really what they're saying is Israel doesn't exist too.
Right.
Which I think people actually, in a bizarre, refreshing way, is almost just easier to hear now. If you don't think that Israel should exist or has the right to exist, just say it. If you don't think the Jews have the right to their own homeland, just say it, so we don't have to have these like pseudo-academic discussions about like food or like cultural appropriation. Right. Like it's nonsense. You know, it's nonsense. But again, if I were Palestinian and I didn't have access to like land, water, or the right to do whatever, I would also be irate. And I totally get it, you know? And so we support as much as we can. It's obviously the relationships are like complicated.
Yeah.
We support Palestinian wineries. We support Palestinian farmers. You know, the door for us is always open and will continue to be open. October 7th and up until now has made things tremendously complicated.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that
we're going to get into that.
Yeah. I can't wait because this has all been so easy.
Right. Yeah. I'm just softball after softball.
Yeah. Totally.
Speaking of a softball, it's hard enough to open a restaurant as it is, but you were also dealing with drug addiction at the time that you were opening Zahav.
Yes.
Most of those stories end terribly, and yet here you are having pulled through it with a restaurant empire.
Yeah.
What was that period like for you, and how did you pull through it to create the life you've made for yourself?
Oh, I mean, the period was hell, and right after Dave's death, I came back to the States and I started smoking crack, not because I'd always had this like addictive sort of personality. I always partied or whatever, but it is interesting. When you are sort of born an addict, it is very hard. And like from the addiction perspective, having a brother killed 3 days before his release on Yom Kippur is just, let's go.
Yeah.
Like, let's go,
I
right?
I need something here.
Yeah, so I get back and immediately I start smoking crack and eventually do heroin. But I was very good at hiding it. And I, you know, met my business partner, Steve, we'd open Zahav and things, you know, it's a progressive disease. So it just got worse and worse, obviously. And, you know, eventually I couldn't hide it anymore. And so 3 months after we had opened Zahav, Steve and my wife at the time drove me to rehab. And I spent 10 days in treatment and then came out and had a rough first couple months. I mean, it's hard to stay clean and sober, especially when the economy is falling out. You know, I mean,
we almost
closed the Hav when I was in like very early recovery. So it was like, It was no cakewalk. But I mean, my now ex-wife, who I love very much, and my business partner, you know, and my community really they're the ones that got me clean and sober. And, you know, Steve used to pick me up every morning. Now, this is somebody that found out in years into a business partnership, after we've collateralized our homes to borrow money for Zaha, found out that I was like hiding like a crack and heroin addiction from him.
Right.
And you know, most people would be like, you gotta
screw this guy, cut him
get out of here. And Steve was like, I'm going to pick you up every day from this AA meeting and drive you into work.
It's amazing.
And I went to a 12-step meeting every day. I went to outpatient rehab 4 days a week. I went to personal therapy. I started like working out. I did all the things.
Yeah.
Started wrapping tefillin. Like I, you know.
Yeah, tried everything.
I found a Jewish sponsor and I was like, I don't know a mantra. Like he's like, you need a mantra. And I was like, I don't have that. And he's like, well, you went to Hebrews. Can you just like recite the Shema? And I was like, I can do that.
Yeah.
You know? So I literally started saying the Shema. Like it was so funny. I know, which I still do.
Amazing. So you and Steve, you've got, since Sahav, you have Goldie, Laser World, Federal Donuts, Lila, Diesengoff, and Kfar Cafe. Did I miss anything?
I think that's it.
Yeah, that's seven. That would be seven.
That sounds right. Yeah.
Give me the one sentence description of each of those spots.
Federal Donuts is hot donuts, well, cake donuts, Korean fried chicken, coffee. A little salad too, but you have to get fried chicken on top of it.
Amazing.
Diesengoff is like an Israeli cafe, lunch and dinner. Laser Wolf is a shipudia, so it's like salad skewers. Shipud means skewer, mm-hmm. So it's like kebabs.
So it's like that's, everything is charcoal. Kebabs?
Not everything is kebabs, everything is cooked over charcoal. And then it's a ton of salads when you get in, fresh pita and hummus.
So how's that different from Zahav?
Zahav has got meze, Zahav is a bit more elaborate. Zahav is a little bit less utilitarian.
Quick question, then you'll keep going. My Broadway fans want to know, is Laser Wolf, have anything to do with Fiddler on the Roof?
Fuck yeah, dude.
Oh, hell yeah, it's for the Butcher?
Of course Butcher, bro. Okay,
Come on.
Yeah,
100%. I mean, I assumed, but you know.
Yeah, 100%.
I love it. We still got Goldie, Lila, and Kfar.
Kfar is an Israeli bakery cafe, right? It's like the place where you go to get like salads, like entree salads if you want, pastries. We do like a Jerusalem bagel that is like stuffed with like egg, you know, and cheese. So it's like a breakfast sandwich meets sort of Israeli snack.
Delicious sounding.
Borekas and pastries. And then Goldie is falafel.
Right.
But it's actually vegan and we actually have a kosher heksher.
Cool.
And it is tahina milkshake, so it's tahina.
I've had that tahina milkshake.
Yeah, very
it's
good.
Like the greatest thing in the world.
Falafel, either sandwich or salad and french fries. And Lila is like a private event space where you can get actually the Sahav experience for like a wedding or bar mitzvah, just in case.
Cool. Hey, good to know.
I know you got 8 years, but we're ready for you.
To a little
and Sahav
out of towner.
Is what people call a modern Israeli restaurant.
Boom. There. You got the primer.
Jaffa actually is going to have shellfish.
I heard that yesterday at the restaurant.
We don't have treif in any of our restaurants. We don't do mixed milk and meat together.
Right, I noticed
Jaffa
that.
Will have a cheeseburger. Jaffa will have like a raw bar too.
And tell me like what's the impetus for Jaffa? Why is it called Jaffa? Why are we doing all the treif and stuff there?
Well, if you were to open a raw bar in Jaffa, like what would it be? You know, and so that was kind of it. And there's plenty of shellfish that served in Israel. And I think we just wanted, you know, we like shrimp. We're Jews. We like shrimp. We like, you
I
know?
Love shellfish. Yeah. I can't get enough of it. And then Aviv, you're opening at the One Hotel in Miami.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's up with Aviv? What's that vision?
I mean, Aviv is like, if we know.
Aviv is spring, right?
Aviv is spring, mm-hmm. Exactly, in Hebrew. And it's like, I think if Zahav and Laser Wolf kind of had a baby, you know, but Whoa. It's an amazing, beautiful restaurant. The One is just, it's a magical experience.
I've stayed there.
It's sick.
Yeah, you know? It's beautiful.
It's beautiful. And they just did like the most incredible renovation to this restaurant. And cool. The team there is wonderful. We love working with them. They're like awesome. So Aviv will be kind of like if we were to open Zahav now after having 16 years of experience of figuring mm-hmm. out and answering some of the questions of like what Israeli cuisine is. Aviv is kind of the answer.
Wow. Sounds incredible.
It's going to be sick.
I'll definitely make my way there.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be hard.
I don't
want to twist your arm to come to Miami and stay at the One, but like,
you know,
yeah.
I'll find a way.
Yeah.
Speaking of like Aviv and the Hebrew name, I love seeing all these restaurants with Hebrew and Israeli names and, you know, the menu at Zahav, it's Al Ha'esh and Mesibah. That means on the fire and party for like the family
dinner.
Right. Is that just like a natural choice or is that an effort on your part to like be introducing these Israeli Hebrew names into the scene?
Well, I think like the way to answer that was like kind of when we decided to open Zahav and call it an Israeli restaurant, you know? And I think that like our publicist at the time was like, are you sure not Mediterranean, not Middle Eastern? Israeli, is that too political? And we're like, this is what it is.
Yeah.
So we're just going to do it. And we're gonna get in there, you know? And so, you know, you can't really exclude like Hebrew. You can't exclude, you know, this is what it is. So I think that it sounds cool. It is what it is. Cooking meat a few inches over charcoal is an incredible way to cook. And I feel like it should be celebrated. And Hebrew, I think, helps sort of evoke that. It's not just a Middle Eastern restaurant. It's not just a Mediterranean. It's certainly not just a Jewish restaurant. It's an Israeli restaurant, and this is the way that we want people to experience it.
What has been your biggest challenge? I mean, you mentioned what your publicist sort of reaction was. What's been the biggest challenge of trying to bring Israeli cuisine to America?
That's sort of the issue with anything Israeli, is that you're always a political talking point.
Right. You're just trying to be who you are and eat the food you want to eat, and people are making a...
Oh, listen, I'm like very... I mean, this is sort of stopped publicly or on social media criticizing Israel entirely on October 7th. Mm. Prior to that, I had no problem doing that. I had no problem flying to Israel and protesting the government, which I've done before.
Yeah.
You know, you just have to scroll back to see. It's like, whatever. Not, you know, I liked criticizing the government like every other Israeli.
Sure.
You know, after October 7th, I made a decision to stop doing that. They don't like understand the nuance.
No.
And I was like, well, if there's like a percentage of people that don't think that Israel has the right to exist, then I'm not giving them one inch of like fuel. Totally. So I kind of like stopped doing that.
I kind of feel the same way. Yeah. You know, I'll get asked like, why aren't you talking about X or Y? And I say, there's a lot of haters who are already sort of talking about X and Y. I don't need to add to that contribution. I can just be doing, you know, saying 100% positive things.
100%. And I like, again, I'm very pro-Jew state. I would be probably categorized as very, maybe not very, but like certainly center left when it comes to Israeli politics and American politics. Like, I just want to cook Israeli food and open an Israeli restaurant. I'm not sure why I need to like answer for like the policies of like a foreign government or whatever. You know what I mean?
You like, shouldn't have to. Did you come up against that a lot?
As we always come up against that, and you do as well. I will say that like when I order like Chinese food or go to a Chinese restaurant, I don't ask the servers or the owners what their stance is on like Uyghur Muslims being in concentration camps, right?
Of course not.
I don't do that. And I definitely don't do that when I go to like Arab restaurants or Palestinian restaurants or Indian restaurants. I find that to be annoying, but it doesn't change. I mean, we continue to open restaurants and
they continue to do well.
They continue to do well. And like, listen, I understand, like I understand why people behave the way that they do. I do. I sometimes have a problem with like double standards and this standard that Israel always has.
Yeah.
I also have a problem with Israeli policy.
Sure.
You know, the issue that I have is like Mike is making hummus. He hates Palestinians. He's stealing it from them the way that like the Israeli government has stolen land or whatever. And I just, Mike, it's just, come on.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And also I just, I'm like, I'm not shutting doors. That is not the way that we're going to like get to a solution that works for everybody.
Yeah.
So I have no preconceived notion that I'm going to make challah or hummus or pita or svenj or malawach or any or jachnun or any of these things. And then suddenly there will be like peace between Israelis and Palestinians. However, I would say that formal historical diplomacy and, you know, diplomatic efforts also aren't working. So like, We got to keep it
connection
moving, you
is
know?
Connection. I mean, it's moving, you got to have the people to people, the shared experience, whatever it is, whether it's athletics, whether it's cooking, you got to be bringing people together. I mean, it's so important. We shouldn't be discrediting it. Just
dialogue is like, frankly, as far as we are concerned, is the most important thing. The problem is sort of post October 7th plus social media algorithms make it very difficult. But I mean, you've experienced the same thing,
sure.
I would imagine.
Yeah, probably lesser degree than you. No one's protested outside my place of business.
I know, because your place of business is everywhere, but like you're still very, very public.
So far, so good.
Yeah.
We'll see. So speaking of October 7th, what was that day like for you as somebody who is so connected to Israel, who's lived in Israel, has people in Israel, and you were here, I'm assuming?
I was here. It was directly after the 21-year anniversary of
your
brother's death.
Right.
Literally the day later.
Yeah.
And I, like all of us, was like, I can't fucking believe this is happening. like, I can't understand this. And then I would say almost equally, I was like, I can't believe that people are doing this to other people and uploading it on social media in real time and then sending it to the victims' families. What the fuck? And then I was like, I can't believe that people in the US are rationalizing this and celebrating this. And in while the blood is still fresh in Israel, like people are then blaming this on Jews. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it was like, well, this is, what do you expect? And I was like, I don't know. I don't expect people to like rape and behead people and light them on fire and video it and then hold hostages. That's what I don't expect that.
Definitely.
Actually, you know?
Yeah. The sense of bewilderment and, and surprise.
Yeah.
As we touched on, I've faced a good deal of controversy in the past year, stemming from what most people would recognize as a very natural support for a Jewish Israeli chef for his own people and home during this terrible time. But some people, including some people on your staff, were perturbed and, you know, which most notoriously resulted in, as I mentioned, this large protest outside of Goldie's, where they were chanting, "Goldie, Goldie, you can't hide. We charge you with genocide."
Right.
What's the feeling when you like see that happening in a place that you care about?
A couple things. One, I'm very proud that we live in a country that allows free speech and the freedom of protest. Number one.
Great.
Right. Like, that's a great thing. People can do whatever they want. I think also it is absurd that I would be charged with genocide for making falafel, right? Or for raising money for United Hatzalah, which is what we're talking about.
That's what they were mostly upset about.
First responder, volunteer-run organization that is also trained Palestinian Red Crescent when the earthquakes were in Egypt, sent over volunteers to go help people out. So like, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's just absurd.
Good. I'm glad that that was more the feeling than some deep traumatic impact.
I don't know. We still, like, everybody's fine.
Speaking of the Hatzalah part of it, you later apologized for saying, you know, you didn't realize they were also sharing supplies with the IDF.
Did
that actually make a difference to you, or were you
morally, we have no issue with that.
Yeah.
It was the Thursday after October 7th. We donated 100% of all of our revenues of all of our restaurants, except for Federal Donuts, to United Hatzalah, right? And we were really proud of that.
Yeah.
The issue was that because of the amount of reservists, which it was 320,000 or something like that, they were giving medical treatment to soldiers.
That's who was being injured.
Yeah. So United Hatzalah was doing that. We did not know that. It doesn't change anything for me morally, but the money that we raised went completely to civilians. We just, when we had announced it to our staff, we did not know that there was any affiliation with the military, and that
so they felt taken by surprise by that part.
That was what we apologized for.
Right.
Okay. And that was like on us entirely. Mm. And, but I don't think from a moral standpoint, we were giving medical aid or treatment to people, and the money that we had raised did not go to anything having to do with the IDF. And because it was through our restaurants and through our companies, we just wanted to make sure that we were transparent with people.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't an apology for like what we had done, just the messaging from our, from us could have been better.
How did it feel to see your own staff, people who are employed by an Israeli at an Israeli restaurant, taking issue with the ownership supporting Israel?
You know, the reality is there's like a ton of restaurants. Like, you don't have to work for me if you don't want to. There's other places.
Of course.
I, you know, we try to be as considerate as possible. The reality of like my identity is what it is.
Yeah, exactly.
So you don't have to work for me if you don't want to. We try to like listen to people and hear people out as much as we can. But the reality, like, these are Israeli restaurants, you know?
Yeah.
And so this is what it is.
Yeah.
So I don't really know what more I could possibly say about that.
This is a tricky question. What's the next like level up for Israeli cuisine? Like, what is there still to be explored and discovered that you haven't done at all of these restaurants?
We haven't done shawarma yet, dude, and I really want to do
shawarma.
Taking
on your own diet.
Shawarma is like very, very hard. We're thinking about a couple different ideas.
What makes it so hard?
So you have to be like really busy, you know? But to make very good shawarma, you need consistent foot traffic, right? Like, you don't want the meat just sitting around.
Right, because you got to be able to be going through.
Exactly.
Okay.
So I feel like, to me, you need to be in a place that knows what this is, and you need to be able to time it correctly. I had amazing shawarma at ABQ.
I was going to mention, I haven't been there yet.
What?
I know.
What the
fuck,
man?
It's like, it's Wagyu shawarma, right?
It's so good.
I know. It's in the valley, so I'm like, I just haven't made it out there. I'm like,
that's like, how far is that?
It's probably like 25, 30 minutes from my house. It's not crazy, but it's like, I don't really have an occasion to be there and just be able in the neighborhood. I'd have to really like destination it.
You got to make an occasion to be there. Dude, ABQ is so good.
I know. I've heard amazing things.
It's so good. And I've heard that, and I haven't been yet to Safi's.
I haven't been to Safi's yet
either. But Ori's like an amazing chef.
So I've been to Bavel and Bestia, but not Safi's.
Yeah, really, really good cook. And then Lior's place, Spice Brothers in New York, is like awesome too. But I want to do shawarma very much. We also want like weekends and vacations and things like that. We're very busy.
Yeah.
I don't know what the next thing is, but I guess to me, I mean, Jaffa is going to be exciting because it is, there's like shellfish.
So different than the other.
Very, very different. And then I would say Aviv, just because I really feel like it's almost like a best of.
So you and I actually met when you were doing a cooking demo at my house with our mutual friend and chef, Aliza Sokolo, which was awesome for me to get to just watch you guys assemble and then get to eat it.
Yeah.
You were promoting your new cookbook, Zahav Home, which you graciously signed for me.
In your home.
In my home.
Yeah.
Tell me about that book and like especially how it's different from the Zahav cookbook.
So Zahav cookbook was Israeli food through the lens of this Israeli restaurant in Philadelphia. So Zahav Home is basically like what happens after you have a bunch of kids and you're like, I want to be able to make food in my house. I want to be able to cook like with one pot. I need to get the shit on the table like fast. It has to be nutritious and like very tasty. And how do I do it realistically? So we disciplined ourselves. And you know, most cookbooks have like a stylist, a this, a that. This was like Steve and I just rolling up our sleeves and actually cooking together in my kitchen.
Wow.
Everything was done in my kitchen. Everything was shot in real time, meaning there was no like design.
Right.
We just made food and we had somebody there literally documenting recipes as we were freestyling.
Wow, that's
so
cool.
So it's like for normal people.
Was that fun to do? That sounds like a blast.
By far the most fun we've had. You should do the cabbage. We do like cabbage cacio e pepe, and it's
cabbage cacio e pepe.
Yeah, it's dope. That's it requires crazy. A broiler in your oven. It's so easy.
We have
it's
a broiler.
So yeah, everybody does.
Yeah,
that's the thing. Everybody has a broiler, and it doesn't smoke out the kitchen.
Yeah,
when you like you know because you're not searing. So
okay,
yeah,
that's top definitely. Of the list.
It's very good.
All right, now we're almost at the end here. I'm gonna just run through some sort of lightning round food questions for you. Number one, go to bagel order.
You know what? This is so basic. I went to Courage.
Which oh, is yeah. Dope. I've been to Courage in LA.
Very good. Yeah. So I am sesame toasted butter.
I mean, sounds That's delicious.
It. That's it.
Yeah. I don't know if I've ever gone with that combo because I'm always like, I want the everything. I want all this flavor. I want the cream cheese.
See, to me, I'm like, I feel like the sesame, I don't know. To me, it's like a perfect bite, you know?
Gefilte fish, Ken or La?
Okay, so the... Why is this the hardest question we're talking
it's
about?
It's very controversial.
So real gefilte fish, I think, is great. I don't like jars of like the shit at room temperature. That freaks me out. Or the jelly freaks me out. Real gefilte means stuffed. I mean, so a real stuffed fish is awesome.
Hmm.
You can make very good gefilte fish.
I don't know that I've ever had like a homemade gefilte fish.
Well, I would recommend you doing it. There's gefilteria in Brooklyn that will mail order you, I believe, gefilte fish. Real gefilte fish.
Gefilteria.
Gefilteria. It's dope. All right.
What's the key to making great schnitzel?
So the key to making great schnitzel is to not flour. It is just to go egg wash and either mozzarella or breadcrumbs. I like to put a ton of spices and salt in my egg wash, and I will soak the chicken paillard in that shit for like hours. Refrigerated, and it'll season and almost cure it. Mm. And then I will like roll it in the mozzarella leftovers that you have.
Yeah.
And like sesame seeds, sometimes whole cumin seeds. I love that shit.
Cool.
Very good.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah, the crust gets really thin.
Nice. What's the one spice we all need to have at home and how do we use it?
The one spice you need to have at your home, well, it's a blend and it's called Hawaj. There's many different kinds. It's a Yemeni blend, but Hawaj just means, it's like curry or like Baharat. It just means blend of spice. Like there's different kinds of them, but the one that I like is the soup spice, which is turmeric, cumin, black pepper. And that shit in chicken broth with noodles or just chicken or with like beef or with whatever, that is just my favorite.
Bam.
All right.
What's the key to great brisket?
the key to great brisket is actually when it's braised brisket, like Jewish brisket,
yeah,
is cooking it, slicing it, letting it rest in the juices sliced, refrigerating it, and then heating it the next day.
How long do you let challah rise for?
I like really, really slow rise, and I like it really sort of puffy. So I like to let challah rise, I mean, depending on air temperature, at least 2 hours.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody better have their pens out. Last thing, we take some questions from social media from people on our Instagram. A Jewish underscore girl who's back again with more great questions. Thank you. What one Jewish food do you think needs the most improvement? And which one do you think gets too much hate but is actually delicious?
Gefilte fish gets too much hate. And I mean, I'd say Ashkenazi food in general gets a really bad rep. Like, think about it. All the Jews that left Europe with nothing, right? They were like leaving pogroms and mm-hmm. coming to the New World, either Montreal or New York or whatever, and had no access to like foraged mushrooms or berries or whatever. So it was like they were cooking on a budget in a city.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing with like Italians coming to New York and not having San Marzano tomatoes. Like right. It's not, they had to adapt, right? So I feel like everybody thinks it's either what, deli, blintzes, or like shitty chicken or right, whatever. Right. That's not Ashkenazi cooking. So in general, Ashkenazi cooking needs not a facelift, but like a connection to like what it actually was.
Jay Brookstein says, for Philly cheesesteaks, Angelo's on 9th. Your thoughts?
Angelo's is an incredible cheesesteak. Del Rossi is an incredible cheesesteak. And I'm like still a Pat's guy.
Yeah.
And classic. Actually, D'Alessandro's on Henry Avenue. Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I don't know if there's like a best. I would say Angelo's changed the bar for cheesesteaks, though.
Wow.
And I think Del Rossi is right behind it. Yeah.
I've never been to Angelo's. It's on my next it's visit sick. List.
Danny is like, talk about great chef. Danny is like the real thing, man. His pizza, too, is so good. His cutlet sandwiches and his hoagies are like next level.
Is this all at the same restaurant?
Same restaurant.
Yeah. All right. Amazing. Last one. Rach.Fleisch back again. She says, it's been a tough year. What's your go-to comfort food and your favorite spot in Philly to get it?
I mean, Fuss 75.
I figured that was going to be your answer. The bowl of
pho is really, really good. I think that...
when my wife was pregnant with my son, it's like all she wanted
was pho. Every morning, yep. Yeah. Well, I will say, okay, so Philly has an amazing Chinatown too. There's a place called Spicy that does hand-drawn noodles that are like amazing as well. So I think it's good, but you know, Rach, is it?
Rach, yeah, Rach.Fleisch.
Rach, you know, I was getting into this before, like we mourn and we grieve and we celebrate and we do it around food. And like, I'm, you know, wolfing down pastries and chava. Like that chava is like my cigarette, right? Okay. So I just wolf that shit down. I think that's kind of what I've been doing. But
do you make it or do you get it from somewhere?
I get it. I mean, we make it. It's not as good as like where you buy it. And Seed and Mill has really good halva too, by the way, and really good tchina. But I really, you know, even just like doing this, I know it's all cheesy, but like this and the bar mitzvah and the pho and the family and being able to share and be heard has been a really wonderful thing. If there's anything that good that comes out of these like atrocities that we have to experience is the renewed importance and gratitude towards like community and through customs. And if there's like anything, you know, I mean, I started rapping tefillin not because I grew up rapping tefillin, it was because I had to deal with like addiction and there was an answer for it, you know? Mm-hmm. And to be able to celebrate and to eat together and to be together has been a gift that I think has been sort of crystallized through all this hardship and through all this grief and all this bullshit that we're all going through at the same time.
Amen.
Yeah.
Let's leave it there, Michael. That was a perfect ending. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, brother.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much to Chef Mike for being here and for his family, for letting him be here, getting away during the important bar mitzvah weekend. He's also got Zahav's hummus out now in Whole Foods, so you can get your own little taste of Zahav at home. Thanks to everybody at Zahav last night for a truly memorable meal, especially Chef Colin, who showed me how to make laffa, and our amazing server, Kiana, took us on a food adventure. Thanks to all of you, as always, for loving the show the way you do. And I will see you all back here for the next delicious episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt.
Thank you to everyone who makes Being Jewish with Jonah Platt possible.
Executive producer Matthew Jones, story producer Sean Leviashvili, and editor Patrick Edwards of Rainbow Creative. Consulting producers Bethany Mandel and Ariella Novak of Shield Communications, social media manager Yuval Yosha, graphic designer Noah Bell of Bellboy Creative, my incredible research assistant Samantha Greenwald, everyone at Aura House Studios, the whole team at Jewish Broadcasting Service, composer Gabe Mann, and of course you, dear listeners, who even stuck around to listen to all these credits. Man, I love you guys.